Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm, as expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of whose program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at buyer risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Well, today, as everyone is well aware, no doubt, is the 10th observance of the Sandy Hook hoax, which was a FEMA drill presented as mass murder to promote gun control. Mary Maxwell, who's published a book about it, entitled Unreality, Sandy Hook Messes Minds, which you can download for free. I'll give you the link for the PDF. Began believing it was real. She has an interesting background as both a PhD, but also an LLB, so that she's highly qualified at research and has a background in the law. She discovered that Sandy Hook had been modeled after the Dunblane shooting in Scotland, where a bunch of kids were killed, and where as a consequence, they banned guns throughout Scotland. That clearly was the motivation behind the events right here in the USA. As I've explained, I brought together 13 experts to sort out what actually happened, including six PhDs. We discovered that the school had been closed by 2008, that there were no students or teachers there, and that it had been a FEMA drill presented as mass murder to promote gun control. In my recent petition to the United States Supreme Court, I included among the supporting documents not only a copy of the FEMA manual for the Sandy Hook event, but a copy of the Connecticut FEMA schedule showing that they were going to conduct the drill on 14 December 2012 at 12 Dickinson Drive, where they even provided a map. I gave that to the Supreme Court. Plus, research done by Brian Davidson, PI, who's a Texas licensed private investigator, who's been into the Connecticut State Police files and discovered, first of all, that all the photographs they have, and there are hundreds and hundreds of them, have had the metadata removed, which means, or so they think, they're not admissible in a court of law. But this is something widely misunderstood about fabricated evidence. The fact that evidence has been fabricated, the fact that metadata has removed, is itself evidence. In this case, of consciousness of guilt. And what he discovered was that in locations where the official narrative, that is to say, the Connecticut Police State own report, said there would be bodies and pools of blood, there were no bodies and there were no pools of blood down the hallway. For Don Hawkspring, who is purported to be the school principal, and Mary Sherlock, who is supposed to be the school psychologist, were supposed to have been killed. No bodies, no pools of blood. Even more interesting, as though that were possible, inside a classroom where you would expect to see a pile of little bodies and blood all over the place. Not only were there no bodies and no blood, there weren't any school desks or school chairs. There was no teacher's desk. There was no American flag. There were no photographs of American president. In other words, what Brian Davidson discovered was, not only did the Connecticut State Police photographic archives not only contradict the Connecticut State Police official narrative, demonstrating no evidence that there'd actually been a mass shooting at Sandy Hook, but he also discovered photographic evidence substantiating that it was not even an operating school. And as some of you may recall, we had a contractor back in 2000. He'd been in Monroe visiting a friend in 2010, and unbeknownst to him, his friend from Monroe was going over to the Sandy Hook school to pick up a couple of school desks on the cheap for his kids to use at home. If you want to find Sandy Hook school desks, you're not going to find them at Sandy Hook in 2012 because they'd already been sold off. Maybe if you visit the friend of the contractor, you'll find a couple there, but they're not at 12 Dickinson Drive because it wasn't even an operating school. All this is before the United States Supreme Court. And I got to tell you, my case was not primarily about, as far as the legal issues were concerned, was not focused on Sandy Hook. That merely made me a controversial defendant in a court of law, but where I was systematically deprived of my right to present a defense and all the evidence I had that nobody had died at Sandy Hook by the judge who ruled that we weren't going down that rabbit hole, that he understood that it was my position that nobody had died at Sandy Hook, but according to him, that had nothing to do with the accuracy or the truthfulness of a death certificate over which I was being sued for asserting it was fake. And let me add, I'm only describing the lawsuit because I'm under an injunction to not assert the claims for which I was sued. I'm merely describing the lawsuit in the absence of which you cannot make heads or tails out of it. Well, what could be more obvious if nobody died at Sandy Hook? Then there can be no authentic death certificates for anyone related to Sandy Hook. And yet on this death certificate, which was incomplete, it had no file number, it had no state certification, it had no town certification. It stated the decedent, Noah Posner, had died at Sandy Hook Elementary School on 14 December 2012 of multiple gunshot wounds. What could be a more blatant dispute over the facts than his asserting he had a son, he had a death certificate that was purported to be legitimate, authentic, who had died at Sandy Hook. In my position, nobody died at Sandy Hook, and the judge just set it aside and said, we're not going down that rabbit hole. In other words, I was deprived of my right to a defense from the beginning. How ridiculous is that? And in addition, it turned out that when I appealed to the Wisconsin Court of Appeals for the Fourth District, they sided with the judge. They said they had the right to decide what facts were reasonable and facts were unreasonable. And as a judge could play the role of the jury, which is to decide what are the facts, Whereas in courts of law, properly conducted, judge only apply the law. Not in this case, not in Wisconsin. He was able to serve as judge and jury, a non-jury trial with a judge simply on the basis of his subjective opinion. And God only knows how it might have been formed. But here you had the Wisconsin Court of Appeals affirming his finding that I was liable for defamation, and even stating that it is reasonable to believe that Adam Lanza shot his mother and then went to Sandy Hook and shot 20 kids and 6 adults, blah, 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 blah. It is unreasonable to believe this is a FEMA drill presented as mass murder to promote gun control, blah, blah, blah. In other words, even the Court of Appeals in consecutive paragraphs affirmed that it was reasonable to assume the official narrative and unreasonable to challenge it. I mean, how bad is that? So I wound up going to the Supreme Court over the violation of my right to a trial by jury to determine the disputed facts. And even though I discovered along the way that the Supreme Court of the United States has never formally affirmed that the Seventh Amendment right to a trial by jury has been affirmed for all 50 states, they declined the opportunity to address this issue. I remain disillusioned in the extreme, to the max. How could the Supreme Court not take this case? And I encourage anyone to review the bidding here. I have all this evidence before the Supreme Court. All the evidence there in appendices you can download to your own desktop. Go to jameshfetzer.org. Check out the press release authored by Ron Avery, to which I've added an introduction where you can download my petition for a writ of certiorari. You can download my petition for a rehearing, because I got a second bite at the apple. And you can download the appendices A through D, where A is the court's own docket for my case, B is a FEMA drill, C is the Connecticut State FEMA showing it was on their schedule, D is a photograph of a crime scene vehicle present at Sandy Hook, where there's crime scene tape up for a crime that would appear has yet to be committed, because there's a string of windows in classroom 10 that are unbroken, but later would be presented as shot out, which means that either the vehicle was there on the scene, and we even have Wayne Carver leaning against the wall with his arms folded, awaiting the arrival of his portable mortuary tent, or they simply haven't finished fabricating the evidence. Either way, it is damning. Either way, it is damning. That was Appendix D. And then in the separate Appendix E, you have the report of Brian Davidson, PI, Texas licensed private investigator, going into the Sandy Hook files and reporting what he discovered, where he concluded that what he has found is more consistent with this having been a FEMA drill to promote gun control than it is with the official narrative. And of course, the evidence is all there. It's only in a court of law where you're allowed to set aside the evidence, declared facts not to be, that they be unreasonable in the eyes of the court, that they could be set aside. In other states, I would have not encountered this experience. It may be this was why they liked Wisconsin to sue me with a manufactured lawsuit. I mean, listen, Allison Menard even discovered that it was a Connecticut statute that states that not even parents are allowed to have uncertified death certificates. And this death certificate, a copy of which had been provided to my research colleague, Kelly Watt, by none other than Leonard Posner himself, who would bring the lawsuit against me, was uncertified. So it wasn't even legal for the parents to have it. Not only that, But I solicited the reports of two, not one, but two forensic document experts, both of whom sided with me that the four death certificates that had been introduced up to that point, because a different certified version was attached to the complaint, and the claim was made they were not materially different when they were grossly materially different, and where Dave Gaharry had obtained an additional copy from the town clerk of Newtown, and I'd obtained an additional copy from the state of Connecticut, though there were four death certificates prior to the oral hearing, during which a judge would find that I was, that there were no disputed facts and that I'd committed defamation of Leonard Bosner. Two forensic document experts concluded that all four, not one, not two, not three, all four of the death certificates were fabricated, were fake. That evidence was before the court in Wisconsin. But it was just set aside. He said during the hearing that it was unhelpful. He justifies this that it's unreasonable. How can it be unreasonable? This is how documents are determined to be authentic or not in courts of law, by forensic document experts. I had not one, I had two. Posner had none. And how could they? Wow. So I'm just blown away that the Supreme Court has not taken my case. I think that Ron Avery, with whom I've discussed this case many, many times, he's an expert on summary judgment in Texas, where he's been involved in a half a dozen or more, won some, lost others, was the first to point out to me how the summary judgment process in Texas was completely different. Where were such a case brought for defamation, you have to assume all of the defense's claims about the facts to be true. That it was a FEMA drill, nobody died. FBI Consolidated Crime Report 2012 showing zero in the intersection of murders and non-negligent manslaughters in Newtown, of which Sandy Hook is a part. All of my position would have to be assumed to be true. And then the plaintiff, the party bringing the case, also known as the movement, because he's moving the case, he's moving the charges, would be asked to agree or disagree. It's real simple. You agree or you disagree. If you agree, then there are no disputed facts. But in this case, if he agreed, obviously I could not have been committing libel. If he disagreed, then there were disputed facts that had to be sent to a jury. But not in Wisconsin. How the Supreme Court could have passed this historic opportunity to affirm the Seventh Amendment applies to all 50 states is beyond me. How the Supreme Court could have overlooked that every resident of Wisconsin had been subjected to a biased, partial, subjective summary judgment procedure. How could they have not cleaned that up? I was merely a defendant who'd been screwed by the process. So the real key, of course, I wanted them to reverse in my case. My God, if we sent it back and I actually had a trial by jury, I could present a mass of evidence, including new evidence I have now. Brian Davidson's examination of the Connecticut State Photographic Archives, for example. And I don't think the jury would be left much in doubt as to whether Sandy Hook was real or not. But reversing for me was only incidental to straightening out the summary judgment procedure in Wisconsin, which are grossly biased and abusive and improper, and seizing the opportunity to affirm the applicability of the Seventh Amendment to all 50 states. How could they not do that? I'm given to understand, after the huge investment in the Alex Jones trials, which have been a political, theatrical extravaganza, they didn't want my case to upset the apple cart. They'd invested a staggering sum of money in having these elaborate trials for Alex Jones, where, by the way, As many of you are aware, I sought to intervene in all of those trials as an expert witness to explain that there's never been a judicial determination that anybody died at Sandy Hook. It had all been on the basis of procedural issues. Agreement, stipulation, default, even Alex Jones was not found guilty on the merits, but because of a purported failure to satisfy discovery. We turned over thousands, tens of thousands of documents. They had all his videos. What could he have failed to provide in discovery? Robert Barnes said he was actually in the courtroom and no one could tell him what it was Alex Jones had failed to provide. Well, after having made this incredible extravaganza, even hitting Alex Jones with a punitive damages of approximately $1 billion for having an opinion, they didn't want to have that all just disappear in the blink of an eye by the Supreme Court taking my case and ruling in my favor. So he killed it. Man, am I disillusioned. Well, I ain't giving up. I'm going to be back in the Court of Appeals right here in Wisconsin again over the taking of my blog and my book, which they had to do. That was the whole idea, to make sure nobody could get access to the book. Well, because there's a $450,000 judgment for the defamation against me, the Bosner team moved to take my blog, James Fetzer.org, and the book Nobody Died at Sandy Hook in Satisfaction. Except they are intellectual property. They are not money. But in Wisconsin, monetary judgments can only be satisfied by monetary awards. That means it's improper. It has to be given, if you have intellectual property, it has to be given to a receiver. The receiver puts it up for bids. The bids determine the value. And then if whoever receives or succeeds in a bid has satisfied the judgment, in other words, if they were selling the book or using the blog to make money, which would be the only appropriate reason for taking them in the first place, then they would return to me after satisfying the $450,000 judgment against me. But it wasn't done that way. The judge himself, in open court during the hearing, said, "This is the way it's often played out. You know, one party just wants to gain satisfaction over the other." You know, the judge himself was admitting that what was going on is an abuse of process. We're going to find out now whether the Wisconsin Court of Appeals can handle even something as minor as this, as violating clear statutes regarding the taking of property to satisfy a monetary judgment. It was clearly in violation of the law. The judge himself was admitting he was violating the law implicitly by explaining what was going on, that he knew the book had no value if it couldn't be marketed. He knew that Bosner simply wanted to get a hold of the book to kill it, in so many words. He agreed to all that. So we'll find out. But the public needs to know. The public needs to know. We're being scammed again and again and again. Well, there's a wonderful woman who's actually published a book, Unreality, Sandy Hook Messes Minds, Mary Maxwell by name, who has both a PhD and an LLB, which means that she has a background in the law that makes her views especially interesting, as I may have already observed. She initially began it had been real. She did further research. Now she recognizes it was fake and that it appears to have been modeled after the shooting in Scotland, the Dunblane school shooting. Well, she just published a piece. I've just republished in my blog today. Mary Maxwell, America's Downfall. The Sandy Hook hoax has lasted 10 years this week. Mary Maxwell. Editor's note, I added a photograph. The photo I added above is of Noah Bosner celebrating his 8th birthday. Count the candles. Pretty good for a boy who died at Sandy Hook at the age of 6. Check it out. go to jameshfetzer.org. You'll find it's right there, my most recent publication. Here's what Mary had to say. 10 years ago, on December 14, 2012, the FBI, or some other part of the U.S. government, actually FEMA, played a trick on the American people. They put out a story that 20 children were shot by 20-year-old Adam Lanza. No kid actually got shot, so that is a happy fact. But it's not a happy fact that folks can be so easily misled. Recently, we have learned that the U.S. government, over many years, regularly tricked the American people in regard to wars and issues of health. Some honest Americans have recorded the details of these deceitful projects. Yet the general public seems unwilling to respond to the exposés. In fact, the exposers are considered to be bad people. In this article, I'll refer to some of the evidence that the Sandy Hook massacre is fictional. But what we need more than proving that is a study of what has happened to the human mind. Maybe it is some combination of the following. One, emotionally, one finds it so hard to accept that one's nation does bad things that this truth has to be kept out of consciousness. Two, the media has such control of culture that anything they print is taken to be reality, and nothing can overcome that. Three, the CIA's invention of the pejorative term conspiracy theorist has worked wonders. As soon as a truth teller comes forward, he can be called by that term, and this lets others think of him as having mental problems. He's peculiar. Ignore him. Four, everybody is super busy these days, and it's burdensome to have to take in the remarks being made by the truth tellers. It's easier to accept the lies. Five, people are afraid of being punished if they side with the truth tellers. They've heard many stories of dissidents getting bumped off or losing their wealth. Best to keep my head down. Six, the intellectual capacity of the average American is much lower than it used to be. People are not stressed by conflicting reports of events. It all seems fine. No problem. The downfall. The title of this article claims that now that 10 years have passed without folks waking up and protesting the lies about Sandy Hook, we may as well declare that America has fallen. I would judge America's international reputation to be very bad. It was once superb, and local patriotic pride to be at a low ebb. The love of truth, as an end in itself, is never spoken of anymore. It used to be a main ideal, both in religious moral terms and as a social trait. People talked about being willing to die for truth. Nowadays, it would be embarrassing to say that. Science will have to shut down. Science's accurate, truthful observation of phenomena is what made it succeed. Why not say the temperature at which water freezes is 41 instead of 32? Who cares? We also won't be able to teach school children how to reason, how to make logical deductions, or how to examine a problem without catering to one's emotions. Emotions will rule the roost. The idea of impartiality in a courtroom will have to disappear. The new style is to say whatever you feel like saying, and perjuring won't even garner a reprimand. Even within a formal statement, you can make conflicting remarks, and that won't cause the statement to be ruled out. Without a firm social value of truth, you can't place reliance on a business contract or even a personal relationship, as promises need to be remembered and kept. Promises can be abandoned if it's now acceptable to lie. You can rewrite history. Presumably, if you tell your 8-year-old daughter today that George Washington said, "Father, I cannot tell a lie. I chopped down the cherry tree." She may ask if you've gone off your meds. People who do insist on truth are now punishable openly as well as secretly. Their writings, deemed misinformational or antisocial, can be wiped from the record. And the writer can be found guilty of sedition, terrorism, or practically anything. Sandy Hook must take the blame. Of course, it's going too far for me to say that 10 years worth of a Sandy Hook hoax are tantamount to the downfall of America. Many things have brought about our downfall. But I wouldn't have thought a visibly false story could be supported, or at least tolerated, by the inhabitants of a city in contemporary America for a full decade. Not that there aren't some Sandy Hook truth tellers, I'll mention three. One who got killed, one who got fired, one who has been under, I'm guessing, a sort of personal house arrest. The one who got killed is William Brandon Shanley. He sued the media and Rupert Murdoch for spreading the lie about the massacre. Not only was he angry, he was a resident of Connecticut. The one who got fired is James Tracy, a professor of media studies in Florida. The case against him, which was First Amendment defensible, was twisted to reflect some other behavior like smoking in the campus no smoking zone or whatever. Both of those cases left the public with the impression that you can't mount a legal case based on truth. The third case is that of a local. I will leave her name out. Initials MC. She has stated in writing that when she realized the massacre was a hoax, she went to speak to the bishop. That seems like a very reasonable and proper thing for a Catholic to do. But he called the police on her. The number of truth tellers is not as small as three, but then there are millions supporting the lies. Even 50 truth tellers would have a hard time speaking. Folks instinctively go with the flow. Some absurdities claimed in the Sandy Hook hoax. I have written a 212-page book entitled Unreality, Sandy Hook Messes Minds. I won't attempt to summarize it here. Instead, I will pick up six absurdities in the story as my way of asking, how could listeners not develop a skeptical feeling when they heard these items? First, the gunman, for whom there is no photographic or audio evidence, is said to have killed his mom in her bed on the morning of the school massacre. No enmity between son and mother had ever been noticed by anyone. This killing is ridiculous. You should majorly doubt it. Second, although it's never admitted that Homeland Security was running a drill at Sandy Hook on December 14, 2012, the town bosses think it's no problem. That electronic sign visible at the scene of the crime says, "Everyone must sign in." That sign is proof of Homeland Security involvement, isn't it? Third, there's a photo of kids in the parking lot, age maybe eight, forming a conga line. They're required to keep eyes closed so they won't see anything, when there is nothing to see in the parking lot anyway. Amazingly, there are no adults panicking in that photo on such a day. Fourth, there's an affidavit signed by a policewoman, Rachel Von Ness, that her job that day included preventing parents from grabbing their children as they escaped from the school. Can you imagine anything as absurd as that? Officer Van Ness must have been ordered to tell that lie. Fifth, some families got their GoFundMe page up and running on the very day of their tragic loss. Come on. We know a bereaved parent would never do that or condone someone else doing it. Sixth, in the official story, the parents never viewed the body of their deceased six-year-old. Identification was done by photograph, whatever that means. We know that even a maternal monkey clings to her infant's body after it dies. No one should have accepted this absurd lie. Giveaways in the court cases. No one has yet been sued or prosecuted directly for the crime of purveying the Sandy Hook hoax at a real event. But various actions have occurred in courtrooms where blatant deviation from the judicial norm is quite telling. I'll give six examples. One, James Tracy, as mentioned, was prevented from using the standard defense against his firing, namely that he has a right to free speech. Clearly, he was fired because he blogged critically about Sandy Hook. And why is it wrong to raise criticism? If the massacre was real, there would be no need to discipline Professor Tracy. Two, a few of the parents successfully sued the homeowners insurance company of Mom Lanza's house in regard to it being the storage space for Adam's guns. Why did not all 20 families join? Three, a woman hospitalized for mental illness in Florida, Lucy Richards, was convicted of harassing the family of deceased child Noah Posner. She was sent to jail for 6 months. Did she really haunt the Posners? Does a mentally ill person really read a conspiracy theory and feel so righteous that she must punish the liars? Didn't the federal judge have doubts? Four, despite being maliciously arrested in Florida, truth teller Wolfgang Helbig has been unable to get fulfillment of the many freedom of information requests he has sent to the government of Connecticut, which he could use to defend himself. He cannot pry out of them an answer to such neutral questions as, had the Sandy Hook school building been condemned for asbestos? Five, truth teller Jim Fetzer, a retired professor of philosophy no less, was sued by Leonard Posner in a defamation case for having, in effect, called Dan Posner a liar, by saying the death certificate he presented for son Noah is inauthentic. If the defaming remark you make is true, the plaintiff cannot win. So Professor Fetzer must be given a chance to show that his insult to Dad is in fact true. The death certificate is inauthentic. Two forensic experts agreed in affidavits. The Wisconsin judge, however, did not allow discovery and made a summary judgment Fetzer to pay $450,000 for defaming Posner. The state appeals court then declined to rule. Six, when Donna Soto and eight others sued Bushmaster Gun, manufactured by Remington Arms, Remington went into bankruptcy before even trying to get the case thrown out. Instead, it could easily have argued that Adam Lanza carried four guns that day. Why blame Bushmaster? Their lawyer also kowtowed to the state, declaring the children's school records confidential. The end of our judicial system. These six instances of funny business in court show that there's a huge problem. I believe each of the judges knew that he or she was supposed to follow the party line. Trying to make justice happen was not even a consideration. They all had to get around it somehow. So why have courts? The old USSR had show trials like this so the Soviet public could be educated as to what will happen to them if they cause trouble. I believe if you submitted my six sample cases to a panel of law-trained Americans who weren't under any pressure to come up with a desired result, they would have ruled as follows. First, Tracy is owed back pay and reinstatement as a firing was a breach of First Amendment rights. Second, the parents of all 20 children should be invited to join the suit against homeowners insurance, by the way. Six adults were also allegedly killed in the massacre. Their families were equally entitled to any damages. Third, it is unlikely that Lucy Richards committed the crime of harassing the Posner family at all. The judge should have required good proof. Note, the story of her arrest may itself be a hoax. Fourth, Helbig should be provided with the means of obtaining information in accordance with the FOIA Act of Connecticut. The criminal case against him was dropped, however, so discovery is not available now. Fifth, there is no question that the district judge should have let Fetzer defend himself, and Wisconsin Appeals Court should have listened to Fetzer's plea. He also tried the U.S. Supreme Court unavailingly. How's that for a shock? And you will see it in the media. Six, the agreement by defendant Remington Bushmaster to let the children's birth, death, and school record be sealed is a perfect giveaway of collusion between the parties. Remington had no stake in closing those records, rather the opposite. What this downfall portends. I ask you to face the gravity of the situation. There is no justice system in America now. The persons who hold judicial-related jobs are acting in malfeasance, if not in plain old crime. Unless you do something about this Sandy Hook matter, which is very simple and indeed contains the happy news that no gunman entered that school, you are lost. We could call a grand jury to investigate each of the judges referred to above, and maybe that Catholic bishop too. Judges and bishops hold a special sacred role in society, and if we find them doing wrong, we'd be crazy to accept it as part of corruption. It is not part of corruption or personal selfishness of the judge or bishop. It is a whole different ballgame in which such person get their appointment on the basis of having passed a test. The test is, will you obey instructions coming from the bad guys, or will you be influenced by truth? If the latter, he, she won't get the job. We really need to stop propping up such a wicked system. Take a few minutes out of your super busy day to notice that if you prop up such a system by your nodding to say a hoax about a school massacre, it will boomerang on you. The entire apparatus of government will become wicked and you will be powerless to act. Poor you. Fight it now, people. Pluck up your courage to say a hoax is a hoax. And it's not okay to hoax us. I want to now review the evidence. I mean, all this has been available, or the most, for some time now. I put up many videos. This is an overview of some of the evidence I was up for presenting in court had I been given the opportunity. The school was closed. There were no students there. The school was Lotus with asbestos and been closed by 2008. It was a FEMA drill presented as mass murder to promote gun control. Even the FBI reported no, zero murdered in Newtown during 2012. Confirmed as a drill by officials in Obama's Department of Education. Here we have a report published the year after as to why hazmat presence would have hampered Sandy Hook renovations. In other words, because the school was loaded with asbestos and biohazards, but they knew that already. That was the reason they closed the school by 2008, and indeed I'm given to understand it actually was closed already in 2006. Here's a review of my book, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook. It was a FEMA drill to promote government violence on gun owners, multiple authors, edited by Jim Fetzer, PhD, reviewed by Brian R. Wright. February 16, 2018, posting editor's comments. I'm reposting this review in light of recent Douglas High School incident in Florida, which looks like a mini-me version of Sandy Hook. At least six contradictions. One of my tweets today, Sandy Parkland is like all the others. I would say most of the others, but I can't think of a single exception, a real or purported mass casualty incident for which the only source of news is government and government media. IOW, we don't really know what happened. And on 11/19/2015, Mr. Fetzer's book was banned from the Amazon catalog 1 month after initial acceptance and posting there. Faking a school shooting to instill fear into a population for political purposes is an act of terrorism. where it has become clear that this instance was brought to us by officials at every level of Connecticut government, from the teachers and reporters to the state police and the Newtown School Board to the governor and the attorney general and the president himself. And this is the ugly legacy of Barack Hussein Obama. James Fatzer. Review of an important book that Amazon refused to publish. This story first came my way by way of Mike Adams and his report that Amazon was getting into the book banning business with this particular title, which to me proved that whatever the book's point was, it was worth looking into. The authors made it easy by publishing the book in PDF format and making it freely available here and many other locations. So I have read the book and digested its essentials. As a professional editor, I find nobody's copy editing and formatting less than stellar. But the book is well organized and the content bona fide. It touches all the bases and answers the hard questions. To an epistemological certainty, nobody died at Sandy Hook. It was a FEMA drill with a purpose of generating support for an extreme gun control and federal power agenda. This review will simply catalog the main factual data that demonstrates a certainty. 489 students minus 20, 469 students plus 70 staff and teachers, nowhere to be found. No evacuation. The benefits to those who participated in the Sandy Hook hoax have been substantial. The donation sites created by families of the victims have hauled in over $27 million, or in excess of $1 million per family. Was Sandy Hook Elementary operational on December 14, 2012, or had it long been abandoned? One, in an interview with Wolfgang Halbig on Truth Radio on March 21, 2014, InfoWars reporter Dan Bondini said at the 5:45 mark, "The school's been closed down for God knows how long. Neighbors can't understand why there were kids in that building because it was condemned." Two, reports of Sandy Hook being elementary being contaminated with asbestos requiring expensive repairs. Three, photographic evidence of an abandoned school. Four, absence of handicapped parking spaces and signage. Five, absence of internet activity 2008 to 2012. Six, Wolfgang Halbig's Freedom of Information hearing. Some more bullet points. According to the United States Social Security Administration Death Master file, nobody died at Sandy Hook Elementary on December 14, 2012. All of the identities of the children victims of the supposed Sandy Hook massacre are purely fictitious identities with no record of either birth or death. As to the adult victims, the only one with an identity possibly verifiable from the intact SSD master file is Victoria G. Soto. The other identities may or may not have been assumed by real people at some time, but the identities themselves are nevertheless fictitious. Secondary copies of the master file, or perhaps earlier versions, appear to have been altered or corrected to include the fake identities. Such altered copies appear to be used by popular genealogical websites, though inconsistently. The situation with regard to Sandy Hook boggles the mind. The Connecticut State Police submitted information to the FBI that a certain 27 people died in Connecticut, but at the same time denies that they died anywhere in Connecticut. That is absurd and revealing. The objective of disinformation is to create enough uncertainty that everything is believable and nothing is knowable. But we have a mountain of proof that the school was closed by 2008 and that no one died there in 2012. Here's a copy of the FBI Consolidated Crime Report for 2012, for Connecticut, for Newtown, where at the intersection of murder and non-negligent manslaughter appears the numeral zero, zero. Sandy Hook Redux. Obama officials confirmed that it was a drill and no children died. By Jim Fetzer with Paul Preston, as interviewed by Sophia Smallstorm. I have a lot of sources in regard to what's going on with the president and the administration and so on. And every one of my sources said it was a false flag. Paul Preston. Sophia Smallstorm, who produced and directed the documentary Unraveling Sandy Hook, which many regarded as the best video study of the Sandy Hook event, recently interviewed Los Angeles school expert Paul Preston about Sandy Hook and his knowledge of what had transpired. Governor Malloy had held a press conference that day explaining that he and the lieutenant governor had been spoken to that something like this might happen, which raised the question, what something like this did he mean? Had he been told a school shooting massacre would take place? Or a drill that would be presented as a real event, which appears to be what took place? Remarkably, we now have confirmation from an unexpected source. Paul Preston had obtained information from officials in the U.S. Department of Education of the Barack Obama administration who confirmed to him, on the basis of their own personal knowledge, that 1, it had been a drill, 2, no children had been killed, and 3, it had been done to promote an anti-gun agenda. Surprise, surprise. Sandy Hook anomalies. It was a FEMA drill for gun control. The photos sent around the world was in a series of stage photos. They rearranged the kids to fake an emergency evacuation photo. There were supposed to be 489 students there that day, minus 20 equals 469. But there are no signs of evacuation where we are told it took place. Here's a classic photograph sent around the world. This has been published millions of times on the cover of virtually every newspaper in the world. This is a version from the New York Times. But there was a second photograph, which Shannon Hicks, a Newtown Beat photojournalist, has acknowledged also taking. We can see a series of parents there standing with their hands in the pockets, their arms folded, casually looking on. And it appears striking that the policewoman, Vanessa, actually rearranges the kid to get a better shot. So a photo with the parents, which was taken earlier, shows a little girl in a pink sweater and a short skirt at the front of the line. They swapped her out for a little boy in blue jeans and a dark sweater who'd been further back originally. They moved him to front, get a more photogenic shot. And if you look here between boy number one and boy number two, you can see several parents looking on just very casually, leading me to describe this photograph as lounging at the massacre. Not only that, but we know where that photograph was taken, in the Sandy Hook parking lot. We also know that had there been a real evacuation, there would have been dozens of strings of kids like that. You got 469 to evacuate, and you only had 15 per divide. That's a very large number. But they're not there. The Connecticut State Police said evacuation was taking place, and they gave very specific information about locations and times. Well, guess what? We have camp dash cam video for those locations and times, and guess what? There's nothing there. There's nothing going on. We're told that you can't prove a negative. Well, that's clearly false. You can go to your living room right now and look for signs of the presence of elephant. Finding no signs of the presence of elephant, you're entitled to infer that's because there's no elephant there. If you go to the location and time where an evacuation is supposed to be taking place, and you find no signs of an evacuation taking place, you're entitled to infer that's because no evacuation was taking place. We even found the FEMA manual for a mass casualty drill involving children. Explains the sign everyone must check in are not normally at crime scenes. Porta potties were already in place, pizza and bottled water available at the firehouse. Many were wearing color-coded name tags on lanyards for identification. Parents were bringing children to the scene as though this were a festive occasion. Think about it. What parent is going to bring a child to the scene of a child shooting massacre? And here we have, from the FEMA manual, we discovered that the preparation for mass casualty be conducted on 12/13/12, beginning at 8 a.m. Exercise play is scheduled until the exercise director controller determines the exercise objectives have been met. Everyone must sign in with the controller upon arrival. The exercise is expected to end at 11:59 p.m. on 12/13/12 and be evaluated on 12/14/12 as a real-time event. In other words, they're going to have a rehearsal on the 13th, and then they're going to present it as a real event on the 14th, which is precisely what happened. And here you can see the sign, everyone must check in. Even the first select man for Newtown, which is a position equivalent to mayor, Patricia LaLorda, testified under oath at a hearing on Wolfgang Halbig's FOIA request conducted in Connecticut that the town had not positioned the sign there, and when asked further who had, she said Homeland Security. But if this was on the up and up, Homeland Security had nothing to do here. Remember, FEMA is a branch of Homeland Security. So what we have is a confirmation from the mayor of Newtown that Homeland Security was there, implying accurately because it was a FEMA drill. We'll be right back.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
That the Capitol will ever treat us fairly. You are lying to yourselves. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. The time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence. At the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet.
not giving up. Revolution Radio.
It is no secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
How can you do better than to have the mayor of Newtown confirm that the sign was placed there by FEMA, by DHS? But there's so much more. Porta-potties were already in place. I asked police officers if they've ever heard of porta-potties at a crime scene. They thought I was joking. We had bottled water and pizza at the firehouse. The crowd, almost all the activity was at the firehouse, which was a third of a mile away from the school, not at the school itself. Bottled water, pizza, standard for FEMA exercises because they provide refreshments and restrooms. Many wearing name tags on lanyards. That's precisely how they manage a drill. You're identified, your role, by color-coded name tags on lanyards. Many parents bringing children to the scene. How absurd is that? Here's the exercise. A badge color, exercise director white, staff black, controllers green, evaluators red, actors orange, support staff yellow, observers blue, media pink. Wow. Who profits from false flag events? The case of Sandy Hook. Attorney General Eric Holder met with Connecticut Governor Dan Malloy on 27 November 2012. The 26 families split between $27 and $130 million. That's over $1 million apiece, up to five, for pretending to have lost a child at Sandy Hook. Pretty good work if you can get it. The school board received a $50 million grant to build a new K-4 school. I checked it out at the time. It only cost $7 million across country for a kindergarten through fourth. They got seven times $7 million to build a new one at Sandy Hook. Obama signed 23 executive orders to constrain our access to guns as a consequence. So the governor of the press conference with the lieutenant governor said they had been spoken to that something like this had happened. And I asked, by who? And discovered Eric Holder had visited on the 27th. So it would have been by Eric Holder, something like this. Only two questions, only two choices. Either he was told that there was a report that some nut was going to go berserk and enter an elementary or a school in Connecticut and shoot up a bunch of folks, in which case he had the obligation to notify the school system to enhance their security that it not happen, which he did not do. Or he was informed they were going to take an abandoned school, conduct a drill, and presented a mass murder, which is exactly what happened. So here's Reuters reported, David Ingram, 27 November. Obama admin is taking a cautious step forward confronting the politically tricky subject of gun violence with an initiative focused on prevention due to be unveiled on Tuesday. The initiative, known as Project Longevity, will send new federal grant money to Connecticut and involve agents, academics, and social workers working for or with the FBI and the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder and Connecticut Governor Dan Bloy are scheduled to discuss the plans at a news conference in New Haven at 11 a.m. Eric Holder, it turns out, at a 2005 National Democratic Women's Conference in Washington, D.C., asserted that we have to brainwash the American people to change their attitude toward guns. I have no doubt this was part of that brainwashing effort. And then on 16 January 2013, just a month and 2 days later, Barack Obama signs 23 executive orders to limit our access to weapons under the Second Amendment. Mission accomplished. Moreover, take a look at the new $50 million Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. The $50 million structure replaces a building that a deranged man entered on December 14, 2012 and mowed down 20 children and 6 educators with assault weapons in one of the worst mass shootings in U.S. history. Well, already, of course, as distorted, even an AR-15 is not actually an assault weapon. That would be fully automatic. It's only semi-automatic. Then as Scott Bennett discerningly observed, it had a corroded barrel. It was an antique. It appears to have been a Vietnam War relic that they used just like a prop. Just like in Las Vegas, when they threw down a handful of shell casings on top of the blood from the alleged mass murderer, Stephen Paddock, where Scott noticed some of them were for CO2, for gas-propelled pellet guns. Others were blank cartridges, and they were on top of the blood instead of under it. But obviously, he didn't keep firing after he was dead. They make these mistakes. Sandy Hook anomalies, obvious proofs of fakery from the start. The cars were parked facing the school, but should not have been. It was a 38-degree Fahrenheit day, but no heat or steam was coming from the building. Entry was staged using a shotgun slug rather than an AR-15 round. Crime scene investigation vehicle present before the crime committed. Here's an aerial photograph of the Sandy Hook parking lot. All by itself, it demonstrates this whole thing was fraud. Notice, no heat or steam coming from the building. Even though it was a 32-degree Fahrenheit, that's above freezing, but it's still cold enough. You would have had to heat the school to conduct classes. They couldn't do it. No doubt because the boilers were dysfunctional from non-use since the school had been closed by 2008. Second of all, there's no handicap parking here. You need that familiar blue and white signage, blue and white parking spaces under Connecticut and federal law at the time. And I verified this in my research. They could not be a legally operating school without those handicap parking spaces. Those handicap parking spaces are not present, therefore this cannot have been a legally operating school. Moreover, the only access route in is via Dickinson Drive, and you can see by the driving instruction, you come in, you turn right, you go around, then you park facing away. But instead, we have all the vehicles in the two center rows parked facing the building. This is because it was simpler to simply bring them in a single line and put them in two by two by two. I mean, after all, who would notice? They were only props. Here's that photograph of which I've spoken now several times. The crime scene vehicle in the parking lot. You can see just above the vehicle that string of four windows in classroom 10. Undamaged. Here you have Wayne Carver leaning against the wall with his arms folded. The flag is at full mast. Crime scene tape up for a crime that apparently has yet to be committed. Looky here. This is how you see it in the photographs. This is how you see it in the photographs on the top left. The four string of windows, they got these paper candles cut out, which, by the way, are among the only what might be considered to be Christmas-type decorations. In fact, you would have thought this whole school would have been ablaze. I mean, you're talking about 14 December, Christmas, Hanukkah. Should have been just covered with decorations. That's what little kids do, but they aren't there. After the event, look at the upper right. That second window is shot out. Here you have lower left. A group of the perps looking at the window trying to figure out what to do. And finally, from inside a photograph showing what they did, was to drill holes in the aluminum frame. And here you can see peak rods inserted. No, they're all exactly 45, 90 degree angle to the window pane. They're all exactly parallel. This is preposterous. No one familiar with firearms would believe this was real. It was clearly fake. If you do a close-up, you can even see some of the filings from having drilled the frames. More. Notice all the furniture is shoved up against the wall. How could you be conducting school with all the furniture shoved up against the wall? The answer, you could not have been. Further proof that the school had long since been abandoned and there were no teachers or students there. More. Sandy Hook anomalies. The forensic analysis was a failure. No fingerprints on the .22 caliber rifle connecting the killer to the crime. Could not match any of 150 slugs to any specific AR-15 weapon. Extraordinary efforts were made to avoid releasing death certificates. Obama, as we already know, signed those 23 executive orders against the Second Amendment on 16 January 2013. Here's a final report from State's Attorney Stephen Sadinsky III, released on November 25th of 2013. Report of the State's Attorney for the Judicial District of Danbury on the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School and 36 Yogalanda Street, Newtown, Connecticut, on December 14, 2012. Where 36 Yogalanda Street is allegedly the residence where Adam Lanza resided. At this point in time, it is relatively trivial to demonstrate that the official report on Sandy Hook, authored by Danbury State's Attorney Stephen Sadinsky, does not establish a causal nexus between the shooter, his victims, and the weapons he is alleged to have used. It suffers from the shortcomings of concluding that there were no fingerprints on the .22 caliber rifle that was allegedly used to shoot his mother, and even more surprisingly, that of the large number of shots that were fired from the 5.56 caliber Bushmaster, close to 150 rounds. None of the bullet fragments could be matched to the weapon, buried in footnote 53. No positive identification could be made to any of the bullet evidence submissions noted in 5.56 millimeter caliber. The physical condition of the bullet jacket surfaces were severely damaged and corroded. They all lacked individual striated marks of sufficient agreement for the identification process. The test fires also exhibited a lack of individual striated marks on the bullet surface for comparison purposes. Under these circumstances, it would have been impossible for the alleged shooter, Adam Lanza, to have been convicted in a properly conducted court of law for his alleged offense, because no causal nexus had been established between the purported shooter, his weapons, and the 20 children and 7 adults he's supposed to have killed, including his mother, which one might have naively supposed was the point of the investigation. But if that was its goal, then its objective was not achieved. If there's ever been such an abysmal failure in the annals of forensic investigation, I would love to hear about it. This is absurd. Moreover, the claim is made that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. But here's an enumeration of evidence that's extraordinary. The final report from Connecticut authorities does not include the names, the ages, or the sex of the alleged victims of the shooting. That is extraordinary. The clerk of Newtown entered into secret negotiations with the state legislature to avoid releasing their death certificates. That is extraordinary. Connecticut State's Attorney Stephen Sadensky opposed the release of the 911 calls, had to be denied withholding them by the courts. That is extraordinary. A special panel of the state legislature recommended state employees who released information about subject Sandy Hook be subject to an e-felony. That is extraordinary. Those who were involved in the demolition of the school building itself were required to sign lifetime gag orders about what they saw or did not see. That is extraordinary. What good reason could there possibly be to withhold the names, ages, and sex of the deceased from the final report about the school massacre? The claim was made that it was to spare the feelings of their parents, but think about it. The parents already knew they were dead. When the book was banned, Mike Adams spoke out loud and clear. He published several articles about it and condemned censorship. He reported how even those who featured me were being censored. He referred to me as being the most dangerous mind in America. Notably, Project Censored has never spoken even a peep about it. The most dangerous mind in America interviewed about false flags and extreme censorship, Mike Adams, published May 6, 2018. And we have a photograph here, by the way, of one of the parents who was also playing the role of a, well, he's called a sloppy sniper. This is David Wheeler. You know, he played the role of a grieving father, but played the role of a SWAT team member walking up and down Dickinson Drive holding a weapon upside down by the magazine. They claimed that this was actually an FBI agent. But the fact is, no one with experience with firearms would carry a weapon upside down by a magazine. I supervised recruit training at the recruit depot in San Diego with 15 DIs and 300 recruits under my command and the lowest ranking private would have known better than to carry a weapon upside down by the magazine. They're designed to be quickly replaced. I mean, the whole point would be your weapon's going to fall to the ground. You might damage the sights or other aspects. This is just ridiculous. Mike Adams. When YouTube banned my entire channel 2 months ago, they were putting strikes on my account for years-old interviews I'd conducted with a conspiracy analyst and author named Jim Fetzer. Fetzer, who I'm now calling the most dangerous mind in America, is the author of a book that was literally banned by Amazon.com. Yes, the same e-commerce retailer that gladly sells books promoting Nazi fascism, deadly communism, and weird sex indoctrination of children went out of its way to ban a book about Sandy Hook. His book is entitled Nobody Died at Sandy Hook. And it lays out the case for why Fetzer believes the entire Sandy Hook shooting was a staged false flag event held in an abandoned school that had no real teachers or students at the time of the shooting. You can download the entire book at this link if you're curious. Notably, I disagree with many of Fetzer's conclusions, but I agree with the right of people like Fetzer to be able to speak. The fact that Fetzer is being banned and censored everywhere shows the authoritarianism of modern society. Even if you think Fetzer's conclusions are nonsense, the banning of his books is nothing short of authoritarian. It is also fairly obvious that if his books were filled with total nonsense, they wouldn't have to be banned at all, because their lack of credibility would be self-evident. Yet the banning of Fetzer's books and videos has been coordinated, aggressive, and merciless. That's probably because his book contains a vast array of photographic evidence that many people find convincing, at least to start questioning the official narrative We've all been fed on events like Sandy Hook. Perhaps Fetzer isn't 100% correct, people might say. But he does raise some very big questions the media has been glossing over. For example, why is one of the supposed SWAT team officers later interviewed as one of the parents of a Sandy Hook shooting victim? And if it's really a SWAT guy, why was he photographed carrying a sniper rifle by the Ammo magazine? No legitimate rifle man would ever carry a rifle that way. I believe in free speech, and free speech includes unpopular speech. So I posted Fetzer's entire book as a PDF document so that you can read it for yourself. I don't endorse all the findings in the book, but I do think the public shouldn't be told what they can and cannot read. Thus, I'm posting this mostly as an act of rebellion against censorship. Remember, the entire establishment says Fetzer is so dangerous that all his books and videos must be censored by everyone from Amazon to YouTube. Don't you find that intriguing? What information in his books is so dangerous that publics may not even be able to see what Fetzer wrote for themselves? Download the book for yourself right here. Note that I don't endorse all the views and opinions that Jim Fetzer found in his videos, books, and articles, but I do agree with his right to speak. Do we really live in a society where Amazon.com engages in online book burnings? The answer is yes. Now YouTube is banning anyone who talks to Fetzer. Fast forwarding today, YouTube is rapidly banning all accounts of anyone who dares to talk to Jim Fetzer. In fact, YouTube is going back in time and finding videos posted years ago that might involve Fetzer. And they are banning all videos that provide Fetzer any sort of voice whatsoever. A lawsuit to suppress a book and punish me for exposing the hoax. Complaint that I had committed defamation of Lenny Posner. The case focuses on authenticity of the NOAA death certificate. The court would not allow me to prove it had been a FEMA drill. Two forensic document experts' reports supported my position. Here was the complaint begins. Plaintiff Leonard Posner here and after plaintiff bring this complaint against James Fetzer, Mike Palachuk, and Wrongs Without Remedies, LLC, here and after collectively defendants, and by and through his attorneys, alleges as follows, and goes on to lay out the nightmare that Leonard Posner is alleged to have experienced. And here I show the death certificate I published on the left, which knows has no file number, no tout or state certification, versus the one that was attached to the complaint, which, as you can see, has a handwritten file number in the upper right, has the town certification across the left, vertically across the left, and has that's to certify this is an accurate document. And then the state certification at the bottom that it's a true copy of the authentic original. The circuit court, at the outset of this case, narrowly limited its focus, advising Fetzer that whether Sandy Hook occurred was beyond the scope of this action, stating unequivocally, this is the judge in my case. Whether or not Sandy Hook ever happened or not is not relevant to this, the truthfulness or the accuracy of the death certificate. Now, I understand the defendant's overall theory in believing that it never happened, and I'm not going to take the bait and let this case go down that rabbit hole. Now, look at the portion of the death certificate, the same in all. Location, Sandy Hook, County of Fairfield. Occurred at a school, 12/14/2012. Died of multiple gunshot wounds. There was massive publicity for a Sandy Hook hoaxer to lose in court, described as a victory for the harassed Sandy Hook parents. Nothing about the procedural improprieties that made it happen. The elements of the offense alleged were not proven in this case. Another occasion for attacking the nutty conspiracy theorist. Here's an example. Jury awards $450,000 to the father of Sandy Hook victim in defamation case. And there's an adorable photograph of the Noah Posner was 6 when he was killed in 2012 shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. Susan Civic wrote, October 16, 2019. A jury this week awarded $450,000 to the father whose battle conspiracy theorist claims that the 2012 shooting death of his son at a Connecticut school was a hoax. In the years since 6-year-old Noah Bosner was killed, Lenny Bosner has tried to stop people from spreading lies about the mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary and from harassing him and other grieving families for proof that the event happened. In June, Bosner won a defamation case against editors of a book that claimed nobody died at the Newtown, Connecticut school. A summary judgment found that James H. Fetzer and Mike Palachek defamed Bosner with statements that his son's death certificate was a fake. On Tuesday, a Wisconsin jury determined the amount that Fetzer must pay Bosner for making defamatory statements, with a foreperson writing in $450,000 on the form. This is a first, said Jake Zimmerman, Posner's attorney. This is the first time someone has stood up to these people and gone all the way. Zimmerman said the case sent an important message that families can stand up for the truth, and it sends a message to those who are spreading the theories. Anyone else who's in the business of harassing families of victims of mass casualty events, which unfortunately has become a cottage industry, it seems, has to look at this and say there is a cost to making these statements. Fetzer and others have cast a dispute as an attack on the First Amendment. Fetzer, a professor emeritus at the University of Minnesota at Duluth, defended the book, which was written by 13 people, and its conclusions. This result represents a significant defeat for collaborative research by citizen journalists in an ongoing effort to offset the pervasive influence of fake news about a plethora of events, including JFK, 9/11, the Boston bombing, and even the moon landing, he wrote in an email Wednesday. When books are banned, the people are deprived of alternative perspectives in the search for truth, as this case so vividly exemplifies. Most Americans, alas, are not in the position to conduct research and sort out truth from fiction, which leaves them vulnerable to narratives that are aggressively promoted by the mainstream media. Conspiracy theories began spreading online almost immediately after 26 people were shot and killed at Sandy Hook in 2012, with some speculating the massacre was a stage event to generate urgency for gun control laws. Even before the funerals were over, grieving families became targets. The people accusing them of being actors paid to play a role. Over time, many assumed they would eventually be left alone, but theories flourished in anonymous online forums and on social media, and Posner received death threats. He founded the nonprofit Honor Network, HONR, to combat harassment. And he and other families sued people who have questioned the attack, including Alex Jones, who runs the conspiracy theory-driven InfoWars website. Kevin Barrett captured the proceeding as a Stalinist-style show trial. The Madison jury had 11 women and one man, all under the age of 30. They claimed my characterization, Posner's team, claimed my characterization of the death certificate had induced PTSD. They projected an image of Noah Posner on the courtroom wall. Their appeals were solely emotional, but clearly persuaded the jury. Kevin Barrett published on October 17, 2019, The Legal Lynching of a Truth Seeker, Jim Fetzer's Stalinist-Style Show Trial, which I think exactly captured the flavor of the entirety. Part 1. Tuesday at the trial, just the facts. Lenny Posner's defamation suit against Jim Fetzer concluded Tuesday, October 15th, day 2 of the penalty phase of the trial. Disclaimer. I've been friends with Jim since 2006, and although I don't always agree with him, I respect his courage and sincerity. It was an honor to have lunch with him on this, the most critical day of the trial. Posner won the first phase last June when the court determined that four of Fetzer's statements alleging a fake death certificate for Noah Posner were defamatory. Then, on September 13th, Fetzer was found in contempt of court for sharing images of Posner's deposition. Fetzer argued that he shared the images, which the court had deemed confidential, as part of his legal defense research. Fetzer claims the images show that the Lenny Posner in the deposition is not the same person depicted in at least some previously publicly circulated images of Lenny Posner. Posner asked for $1 million in damages from Fetzer. The jury's job was to determine an award amount, which theoretically could range anywhere between $0 and $1 million. After almost 4 hours of deliberation, the jury returned a verdict of $450,000 in damages. Jim Fetzer, called to the stand by the plaintiff's lawyers as a hostile witness, was questioned about his responsibility for the four allegedly defamatory statements, all of which involved claims that the copy of Noah Posner's death certificate circulated by Lenny Posner in 2014 was inauthentic. Claims, Fetzer still argues, were accurate. Fetzer said he and, in some cases, collaborators, including co-authors, editors, and publishers, were indeed responsible for publishing those statements, which were not defamatory, but truthful. Dane County Circuit Judge Frank Remington immediately ordered the jury out of the room and admonished Fetzer that the court had already ruled that those statements were defamatory and that no further impugning the findings of the court would be tolerated. When the jury filed back into the courtroom, Judge Remington ordered them to ignore Fetzer's statement. Do I miss a closing argument? I had to pick up my wife after a dental appointment. A friend and colleague who wishes to remain anonymous summarized them for me. What follows is based on what my source, who was present in the courtroom as a spectator, recounted afterward. Posner's attorneys made broad emotional appeals, saying Posner has experienced pain and suffering due to losing his son and then having the wounds reopened by his battles with online San Diego skeptics, whose ideas they claim are derived from Fetzer's book and web posting. Fetzer's attorneys argued more narrowly on two key issues. They asked why the psychologist expert witness who diagnosed Fetzer, diagnosed Posner with Fetzer-induced PTSD, did not estimate any monetary damages from that PTSD, nor, in fact, did Posner or his legal team. No claims were made about the dollar value of any losses in earning ability. Posner may or may not have suffered. There was no claim whatsoever of any loss of income or medical bills. Posner's team also argued that Posner's side had not presented any convincing evidence supporting the claim that Fetzer's defamatory statements about the death certificate had called Lucy Richards or any other unstable Sandy Hook skeptic to harass Posner. No evidence was presented that the harassers even read Fetzer's defamatory statements, much less acted on them. Fetzer's lawyers reminded the jury to set aside their personal feelings and emotions. They shouldn't decide on the basis of whether they like or dislike Fetzer or agree or disagree with him. Damages are not supposed to be emotional or punitive, Fetzer's attorney said, but are only related to actual dollar value loss, which had not been demonstrated. The jury retired to consider their verdict. A few hours later, well into the evening, they ordered pizza. A few mainstream journalists, including a New York Times reporter, remained in the courtroom to await the verdict. The jury returned the verdict after about 4 hours of deliberation. Jury awards Sandy Hook father $450,000 damages for defamation. Part two, the opinion piece. Assuming we are still allowed to have opinions. Tuesday was the final day of Jim Fetzer's defense against Lenny Posner's libel lawsuit. I attended and published a Just the Facts report that evening, republished with minor changes above. At almost the same moment I published my initial report, the jury came back with a verdict awarding close to $500,000 to Lenny. Jim Fetzer gave me PTSD, Posner. Now it's time for an opinion piece. Inasmuch as I sympathize with Mr. Posner, assuming his account is accurate, my opinion is that Jim Fetzer got a raw deal and that the reverberations from this case will be disastrous unless it is overturned. The whole courtroom drama was carefully scripted and controlled to ensure that the jury, as well as onlookers and reporters, got to hear only one side of the story. Fetzer was never allowed to present his defense. Jim Fetzer's defense is simple. Truth is an absolute defense against libel. And Fetzer published statements alleged by Posner to be libelous because he believed them to be true. What's more, he still believes them to be true. Whether he is right, I do not know. But I do know he is sincere in his beliefs. I watched Jim Fetzer take the stand, swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, and then watch him silenced and admonished, and the jury hurriedly chased out of the room when he tried to speak the truth as he saw it. Jim merely said that he believed his libelous statements were true. Asserting the contrary would be a lie. Not saying anything would be a lie by omission. So he was admonished and threatened by the court for the sin of not lying on the witness stand. As I understand it, at no point during the two phases of the trial was Jim Fetzer ever allowed to present to the jury evidence that led him to believe Sandy Hook was an Operation Gladio-style psyop, which those who have read Daniel Glazer's NATO's Secret Armies know is entirely plausible, and that there was no actual school shooting, which does seem far-fetched, but stranger things have happened. How could he present a truth defense without showing the evidence that led him to believe his alleged libelous statements were in fact truthful? According to the Seventh Amendment of the Constitution, in suits at common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved. Yet, as I understand it, and perhaps someone can correct me in the comments if I'm wrong, Jim Fetzer was never given the right of trial by jury to determine whether he had or had not committed libel. Instead, an obviously biased judge presided over that crucial first phase of the case, denying Jim's constitutionally guaranteed right to a trial by jury. The same judge prevented Jim from presenting his truth defense, which would have entailed giving Jim full scope to present the evidence that led him to believe his statements were truthful and therefore not libelous. It was only in the second penalty phase of the trial that a jury was convened. And during that phase, not only was Jim prevented from presenting his truth defense to the jury, he was prohibited from even mentioning it or from telling the truth about his beliefs. Meanwhile, the Posner team was allowed to engage in shameless emotional manipulation of the jury. They even projected a huge, adorable picture of Noah Posner on the screen as a backdrop to the crucial back-to-back testimony of Leonard Posner and Jim Fetzer. Jim Fetzer, of course, was not allowed to use the big screen to project images to raise question about the official story of Sandy Hook. Images that can be found in Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, but which were, along with all other evidence supporting Fetzer's truth defense, in essence, banned from the courtroom. Meanwhile, Ron Avery dissected the ruling by the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. Summary judgments are only appropriate if facts are not in dispute. The authenticity of the death certificate clearly remained in dispute. They drew every inference against the defendant and in favor of the plaintiffs. It was wrong for me to be denied the right to present my defense. Ronald F. Avery. To support the Sandy Hook narrative, Wisconsin Court of Appeals District 4 makes gross errors. On 7 May 2021, Dr. James Fetzer filed his appeal to the Wisconsin Supreme Court to review the rulings of the Circuit and Appellate Courts of Wisconsin, finding that Dr. Fetzer committed libel as a matter of law by publishing that a death certificate of Leonard Posner's son was a fake. Yet all agreed that this said death certificate was not sealed and signed by the necessary parties to complete it. I discovered this case early on and created a website to archive the most important court documents filed in the case at a dedicated website and archive. The obvious, deceptive, and ridiculous ruling violated all the principles of the use and purpose of a summary judgment in every state in the union. A summary judgment is a judicial tool to expedite judicial proceedings when all of the relevant alleged facts of both parties are not in dispute, meaning there's no need for a jury of one's peers to find the facts to make sure all the elements of a claim are presented before damages can be determined and awarded. But where there are disputed alleged facts relevant to the elements of a claim, a summary judgment cannot be employed, and a jury of one's peers must be called for to find the relevant facts. One cannot find the elements of a legal damage claim if the facts of the case are not known. And if the two parties disagree as to the alleged facts, a jury must be called. But if both parties agree to the facts, then why have a jury to find facts? Simple, right? Not simple in Wisconsin. There are some rules to ensure that those who have a summary judgment against them are not cheated out of the due process and a chance to be heard by a jury if the law is being applied to the wrong set of facts. First, there cannot be any relevant facts pled by either party that are in dispute. Second, all questions of fact must be resolved in favor of the non-movement or the one the summary judgment is filed against by the other party. Third, all inferences that could be reasonably drawn from the facts pled by the non-movement must be made. These are the three main rules. All three were violated in the summary judgment against Dr. Fetzer. First, there are few, if any, facts alleged by the parties that are not in dispute. Mr. Parter claimed that the death certificate, without all the seals and signatures, was not fake, and his son was killed at the alleged Sandy Hook Elementary mass shooting. Dr. Fetzer filed a plethora of evidence to support his allegation that no one died at Sandy Hook, and it's no death certificate from that event could be real and authentic. His evidence included a book he edited entitled Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, It Was a FEMA Drill to Promote Gun Control, 2015, second edition, 2016. Listen to the opinion of the Wisconsin Fourth Court of Appeals in stating the undisputed facts in this case. On December 14, 2012, a mass shooting occurred at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. Tragically, 26 people were killed, including 6 staff members and 20 children who were aged 6 and 7. See, for example, Joan V. Heslin stating, Heslin's son was killed in the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting in December 2012 and rejecting the substantial truth doctrine as a basis to dismiss Heslin's defamation claim related to statements disputing Heslin's assertion that he held his deceased son in his arms. Soto v. Bushmaster Firearms, quoting therefrom, on December 14, 2012, 20-year-old Adam Lanza forced his way into Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown and during the course of 264 seconds, fatally shot 20 first-grade children and 6 staff members and wounded 2 other staff members. Posner's 6-year-old son, Ian, was one of the children killed during the Sandy Hook shooting. How on earth did the above scenario become the undisputed facts in this case? When did Dr. Fetzer agree to that set of facts? There is no such agreement anywhere on record. Therefore, this violates the first rule on summary judgment. Notice also the appellate court cited 2 cases to deceive the casual reader that Sandy Hook is an adjudicated reality. But when these cases are reviewed, we find that neither considered what happened at Sandy Hook. This is unethical to attempt to trick the reader into thinking Sandy Hook is an adjudicated fact of history when neither case reached the question, much less answered it affirmatively. Second, all fact issues in question were resolved in favor of the movement, Mr. Posner, rather than the non-movement, Dr. Fetzer, as required by law. Several times the circuit judge said he was not going down that rabbit hole or going to educate himself on the larger controversy. Well, I'm sorry, but he doesn't have that lawful discretion to ignore the relevant alleged facts of the non-movement, which bear on the issue of the authenticity of an alleged death certificate coming from an event that did not happen. Prior to granting the summary judgment, the judge must resolve any fact question in favor of the non-movement doctor of answer. For the judge to have granted this summary judgment, it would need to sound as follows. We take Dr. Fetzer's allegation of fact as true, and all questions of fact are resolved in his favor, and all inference from his facts are made showing that the mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary did not happen on 12-14-12. We now find that Dr. Fetzer, the famed Mr. Posner, when he published statements that the death certificate of Posner's son, the victim of that event, was fake. Does this not shock your senses? Is this not a slap in the face of human intelligence? This is a logical equation, and it cannot be altered without altering the other side. In order to find Dr. Fetzer guilty of libel in this case, they must accept his allegations of fact and all inferences from those facts and find that Sandy Hook never happened. But rather than do as they should have and deny Mr. Posner's motion for summary judgment, they granted it and at the same time resolved all questions of fact in favor of Mr. Posner. They cheated and continue the state of war against Dr. Fetzer and his property. Third, all reasonable inferences must be drawn from the non-movement's allegation of facts, concluding that Sandy Hook never happened, and therefore no death certificate resulting from that event could be real or legitimate. So all three of the main rules of summary are violated in the rulings of the circuit and appellate courts in Wisconsin. To further illustrate the complete saturation of this case with judicial corruption, the circuit court granted this summary judgment in favor of Mr. Posner after Dr. Fetzer had provided not one but two document authenticity experts who both testified that the four versions introduced into the case at that point in time, the one published in the book, the one attached to the complaint, one obtained from the Newtown clerk, and a fourth from the state of Connecticut, which were different versions of the same death certificate, were fake. Mr. Posner presented the testimony of a funeral homeowner who said he filed out part of the death certificates, but did not provide even one expert to attest to their authenticity. The judge and the jury, if seated, must go with the opinion of any contested expert witness. These two experts, being uncontested, should have resulted in the dismissal of the case against Dr. Fetzer instead of a grant of summary judgment against him. But let's presume the judge wanted to hear more of the facts in the case. He should have denied summary judgment and sent the case to trial, as the two experts raise a disputed fact issue as to the authenticity of the death certificate in question. If Posner really wants to win this suit, he must do it before a jury, not on summary judgment. And all these judges know it more than anybody else. And for that, they should be disbarred. There is another travesty in this case, which springs from the abuse of judicial proceedings. Dr. Fetzer released some discovery that was ruled to be confidential as a means of crying out for help. And he was fined several thousand dollars for contempt of court. At a later time, he released more discovery that was ruled confidential. This time, the judge awarded Mr. Posner's attorney fees as a penalty for Dr. Fetzer's continuing contempt of court in the amount of $650,000, an outrageous amount considering the following. The jury that was called to hear Mr. Posner's damage evidence awarded $450,000, but the judge awarded $650,000 in attorney fees for contempt of court. It seems extremely zealous to award more from contempt of court than what the plaintiff gets from a jury. Dr. Fetzer's contempt of court seemed to be warranted by the treatment he received and continued to receive in this so-called judicial system. All the rulings of the circuit and appellate court should be reversed, and the case remanded to the circuit court for trial on the merits, with special instruction that the defendant's pleading will no longer be ignored, no matter how pleasant they may seem. We know how they fake the kids. They use photos of older kids as children. Kelly Watt, who received a copy of the death certificate from Leonard Posner, which he shared with me, observed that Noah looked surprisingly like Michael Vabner. who is supposed to be his older half-brother, with the same eyes, eyebrows, mouth, nose, shape of head, ears. Lori Rivera, a colleague of mine from JFK Research, created a GIF where you can see Noah turning into Michael. The person who testified, moreover, doesn't appear to be Leonard Posner. Here's a photograph of Lenny Posner with little Noah. Here's what Kelly noticed, that they have the same eyes. Dr. Ewan cropped photos of the two and focused on their ears. Here's her side-by-side comparison. At first, Noah's left ear appeared to have a smaller lobe than Michael's, but a picture of Noah's right ear reveals a lobe like Michael's. At conclusion, they have the same ears. If Noah and Michael have the same ears and ears are as distinctive as fingerprints, then we have proof that Noah and Michael are one and the same. That is as powerful as fingerprints, which of course are frequently introduced at courts of law. See if you can tell which ears Dr. Ewan selected for comparison. Try one of your own. Larry Rivera has done brilliant research, proving that a figure known as Doorman, standing in the doorway of the Texas School Book Depository, was in fact Lee Oswald. As Harold Weisberg, Jim Garrison, and other serious students of JFK have believed. So I was sure he could help to resolve this issue by superposition. So I sent the two photographs without identifying who they were or any context. And he created a GIF where you can see Noah Posner turn into Michael Vabner. What more could you ask for proof that Noah Posner was a fiction created out of photographs of Michael Vabner when he was a child? There you see it. Either you believe your eyes or you don't. Reminded of the Richard Pryor joke. Who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? Stunning stuff. And here, I was actually able to paid $7,000, really, to get the photograph into the record in the middle, the party who came and testified. Editor's note. The reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, Chris Rickert, got most of this right, but he had Mike Palachuk residing in Saginaw, Michigan, rather than Saginaw, Minnesota, and had the transfer of the video deposition occurring July when it occurred in August. He corrected both of these mistakes, but kept a claim. Images of Posner from the deposition and from past new coverage appear to show the same person, which might be okay in an opinion, but which was published as a fact. I shared it with Allison Maynard and with Wolfgang Halbig for confirmation of my suspicion. They are not the same person, which you can judge for yourself. See it there. Here are two other photographs of the party who appeared at the deposition and the party who has been widely noted as Leonard Posner worldwide. In fact, a point I made was, how could it possibly be the case? How could it possibly be the case that they'd object to the image of Leonard Posner from the deposition when his image has appeared millions of times worldwide, if indeed it were not actually Leonard Posner? Obama was responsible for legalizing all of this. There's more I would cover had I had the time. Alex Jones has been pilloried. I just say you want to read my latest now about what happened here on my blog at jamesfetzer.org. And I'll merely close with the observation that we have the further evidence from the Connecticut FEMA files that they were conducting the drill on 14 December 2012. They even provided a map. State of the Union said this may be the single most important issue brought before the Supreme Court in our lifetime. We have a photograph down the hallway where the bodies and pools of blood should be found. We have photographs in the classroom where there are no bodies, no blood, no student desk, no teacher desk. Here's a conclusion. At this point in time, my position is that the evidence appears to be more consistent with the alternative account of a FEMA exercise presented as mass murder to promote gun control, signed Brian Davidson, Panoramic Investigation, Texas private investigator. In here, I close with what I've tweeted to Elon Musk, suggesting bring back Alex Jones, at Elon Musk, bring back Alex. He didn't get it wrong. Here's Noah Posner celebrating his Earth 8th birthday. Pretty good for a kid who died at the age of 6. Count the candles. You can find that on my blog right now, James H. Fetzer. Don't let yourself be played. the government has been lying to us again and again and again. This case matters to you and your right to a trial by jury, which we all have assumed was guaranteed by the first 10 amendments. The Supreme Court failed to act on our behalf. I am acutely disappointed and distressed. Every American needs to understand what happened here. Thank you for joining me today. And if I have a moment more, I'm continuing to pursue this in the Court of Appeals in Wisconsin and any other move I can make to expose the truth, because the American people are entitled to know the truth about their own history, whether it's JFK, 9/11, Wellstone, Sandy Hook, Boston bombing, Orlando, Dallas, Parkland, Charlottesville. I'm doing everything I can to bring the truth to the public. And I'm so grateful for your support. Meanwhile, spend as much time as you can with your friends and loved ones. We literally do not know how much time we have left.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs, government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyal? Is it sedition? Is it treason to oppose the hands of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me,
give me liberty! Oh, give me!
A dark cloud is finally lifting across the world as U.S. military intelligence...